Welcome to the Institute for Government. I'm Jill Rutter. I'm Programme Director of our Better Policymaking project at the Institute for Government. And one of the things we've been interested in exploring in a series of seminars are some of the ideas set out in Michael Hallsworth. Michael is going to wave. Michael Hallsworth's excellent working paper, System Stewardship, which is looking at how, what are the challenges of policymaking in a much more complex environment where you can't just assume, if you ever could have done, that you pull on a lever and everybody does exactly what you expect and you have exactly the outcome that you intended. We've had a series of seminars exploring those issues, but I'm absolutely delighted that today we've got Eric Beinhocker to talk to us. It's quite appropriate that it's such great weather, actually, because I associate Eric with great weather because various friends of mine were all raving about his book, The Origin of Wealth. So, of course, being a saddo, I took it on holiday with me, which is probably the only time when you get enough time to read that. So highly recommend it if you haven't read it already. But Eric is Senior Fellow of the McKinsey Global Institute. He's author of the aforesaid Origin of Wealth, available on Amazon and other places, and advised the Institute of New Economic Thinking. He's also doing some work, I think, on growth with IPPR and a variety of other things. So this is going to be, those of you that are familiar with Institute events will have to cast aside your expectations, because this is going to be a bit different, a bit trially and experimentally. What we're going to do is Eric's going to talk for about 40 minutes. We're then going to have a bit of Q&A. Did any of that make sense? What he then suggested was that it might be nice if people had a chance to try and explore those concepts in a variety of themed discussions. There have been various people who have been asked to lead some of those discussions. They know who they are, and hopefully they're all here. But I was told I had to allow for emergence, and therefore if anyone, you're sitting there and think, yay, I'd really, really like to apply this to blank, then be prepared to offer, and showing our flexible and resilient organisation, we will instantly be able to respond and you will be given a piece of magic paper and a pen and somebody may come with you to join you in that discussion. So it'll be slightly open spacey, and then we'll be convened back after about half an hour, just say, not feedback, plenary one, plenary two, normal thing, but just say, actually, did that feel like a different way of doing policy? Did it strike you that there was mileage in this, or did it strike you that this was actually something that wasn't going to change at all the way you did your day job? So, on that slightly downer note...
And then we have drinks after.
And then we have drinks. You could possibly combine drinks with the workshop, but that slightly depends on how our logisticals are working out. But, you know, it's the IFG. There are always drinks. So many thanks to all of you for coming. I was saying to Eric earlier that modelling turnout at IFG events is near impossible because it's a... has to interact with what the minister's doing, what's going on in Whitehall, are there any crises, and crucially, what's the weather like? But I'm sure you're going to be really richly rewarded for forsaking the sun and listening to Eric Beinhocker.
Well, thank you very much, Jill. Thank you all for coming. When Jill invited me to do this event, I went on the IFG website and took a look around at what some of the other events were. And saw, you know, quite a number of very practical, very relevant topics and big challenges. And I thought, boy, I'm going to lower the tone here because expectations, you may not actually learn anything that's practically useful today. Rather, I have a slightly different objective, which is to intrigue you or tweak your curiosity so that you want to learn more about this topic and explore these ideas. People like you exploring and working on these ideas that over time will develop some interesting new practical approaches. Just to get started. The question we want to ask is, well, what do these guys need?
Policymakers.
I couldn't find a really goofy picture of our prime minister. I think his press crew are a lot more guarded than whoever let the picture be taken.
But we know that
senior policymakers today, they don't need another Berlusconi bunga bunga party, but what they do need are big changes the world faces. And at the heart of many of the challenges that the world faces today are economic issues, whether it's the financial crisis, growth, poverty, or climate change. And the key theme of this talk is going to be that we need an economics that describes the real world, that what's actually happening out there to help give us solutions to these types of problems. And the hope is that if we can describe the real world better in greater fidelity, question, can we fix it and come up with solutions? Now, this cartoon was sent to me by a friend who was at the IMF meeting last week, and this will give you a sense of the mood from Washington last week, but hopefully it'll get a little bit better. We're going to touch on a couple of topics. First, I'm just going to start with a few facts. They have nothing to do with anything you guys are probably dealing with in your daily life, but they're interesting facts to an economist. And facts that I believe need an explanation and are, in fact, hard for traditional economic theory to explain. And then I'm going to offer a different view on the economy than what's traditionally been in economics textbooks and used in policy, what I call complexity economics. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about how that perspective works in terms of looking at how human social systems evolve, develop, and grow over time. And then we're going to try to land with, if not exactly practical how-to insights, with some thought starters on new ways these ideas might be applied in public policy, and then that will take us into the breakout discussions where you guys will have the hard job of actually figuring out how to make this stuff useful. So first, just to start with a few intriguing facts to kind of whet the appetite. Fact number one is that wealth on a global scale has actually grown very explosively. It hasn't been a nice, linear, smooth development, but rather it's looked like this. Now, this is a time series you don't see very often. It's world GDP per 2.5 million BC to present. And we have to admit the statistics back in 2.5 million BC were not that great. ONS will not certify these numbers. But I'd say it's a semi-serious data set put together by Brad DeLong at Berkeley, where he cobbled together data from the archaeological record on how many calories people had, what kind of stone tools they had, and so on, with increasingly better data as we go forward in time. And basically, the pattern of the world economy has been for a long, 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 long time, we were really, 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 really poor, and then all hell broke loose. And if we zoom in to what an archaeologist would say is the very recent past, about 15,000 years ago, which is about when settled agriculture started taking off, again, we see this same pattern of boom. And then if we zoom in again, we see that really that economic growth went through this just explosion starting around 1750, 1800. Now, of course, we know what happened circa 1800, the Industrial Revolution. And we have a great narrative as what happened and how many steam looms and, you know, trains and other things were built during that time. But we don't actually have an economic theory that can account for this pattern, where a system will kind of trundle along in a relatively low state and then just go through that kind of explosive growth. Economists traditionally kind of punting on the answer. Fact two, that while wealth has grown explosively over a very long time, complexity of our economy has also grown. And there's a measure that I borrowed from retailers called stock keeping units, which is a shop might have, you know, 10 different types of blue jeans in it, even though it may have multiple copies of each. Those are stock keeping units. And anthropologists, when they look at hunter-gatherer tribes, which is how the world lived up until settled agriculture, they find that they have about, you know, a few hundred different items, different types of, you know, woven baskets and tools and things like that. Whereas a modern economy, I estimate, has something on the order of 10 to the 10 product variety. You know, just for an example, the average Walmart store in the U.S. has 100,000 different types of products in it, and then lots of copies of each. Or my favorite, that there's 270 different types of breakfast cereal available. So we've had this huge explosion in the variety and complexity in the economy as it's grown wealthier. Fact number three, that all of this happened with there's no sort of top-down plan. This emerged in a very bottom-up fashion. Fact number four is that all of this growth and order creation
creation came. This is a chart showing carbon emissions or carbon concentration in the atmosphere, you know, from 10,000 years about settled agriculture to now. And this is my Al Gore moment. So watch this. Isn't that cool? That's the that's that GDP per capita chart that I showed you before, and you can see there's some connection here. Now, that has absolutely no statistical meaning since I scaled things to make it look cool, but it sort of it gives the right message that there's some relationship going on between that order creation and growth and what's going on in the environment. And then lastly, fact number five. We've gone through this incredible event of a you know meltdown in the financial system, kicking into the full economy, and starting from a small corner of the U.S. Mortgage market, and then expanding globally. So, what kind of system could actually create this kind of behavior? Explosive growth, variety creation, collapses, and so on. Well, the traditional way we've explained the economy for about the last 100 years has been what economists call neoclassical economics. And this is the economics you find in most textbooks even today, and provides the basis for a lot of public policy analysis. And it basically looks like this. The economy is assumed system at rest, where essentially you have a set of forces, you have a set of constraints on the system, the utilities and preferences of consumers, or constraints on producers, their technologies. Then you have some self-interest causing consumers and producers to try to optimize their behavior, and that combination of constraints, like the side of the bowl, and forces, like the gravity here, brings the system into an equilibrium resting point where supply meets demand, and everybody's happy. And the origins of this thinking go back to the 1870s, when a group of economists at the time were trying to introduce mathematics into economics and borrowed a bunch of equations basically out of physics textbooks. And at the time, the physicists were very interested in these equilibrium systems. And so that's kind of how modern economics got going. But there's a basic problem that these kind of equilibrium systems don't do the five things that we just saw. They don't spontaneously, endogenously grow. They don't create, there's no mechanism for novelty, creation for newness. They don't self-organize, and they also don't just spontaneously collapse. And so to do those things that we just saw, economists have reached to call exogenous factors, you know, things outside the economy that are feeding into it, shocking it, to make those the economy as an equilibrium system or a system at rest has also been very much baked into the way we do lots of public policy. And I've always liked this quote from practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influence are usually the slaves of some defunct economist, that the defunct economists that we're slaves to today are really the economists going from Walras and Jevons back in the late 1800s through Marshall and Samuelson, Milton, in more modern times, this stream of what's called neoclassical economics. And ideas of equilibrium have become deeply embedded in a lot of the policy tools we use. So if you open up the cover in most central banks or finance ministries, you find what are called DSGE models, dynamic stochastic equilibrium models, and those are basically a ball in the bowl view of the economy. Also, when we do cost analysis and climate change are the types of models used in something like the Stern Review. That's another example. The Washington Consensus and Development. And the whole response to the financial crisis has really been driven from this a lot from this perspective and the debates we've been having about fiscal tightening versus stimulus and moral hazard and so on really come from that equilibrium. Equilibrium framework is also politics as well, and the way we think and talk about left versus right also comes out of that intellectual tradition. Now, crisis, many policymakers started to really question whether this ball-in-the-bowl equilibrium model was a good description of the reality that they were experiencing. And this is a quote from Jean-Claude Trichet, the president of the European Central Bank, where he said, and I think he can read it, but the key point at the end, he says, we felt abandoned by the conventional tools. The models that they had in the European Central Bank, these equilibrium DSG models, could not reproduce what they were seeing in the crisis, because every time they ran the models, they went back to a happy ending, a happy sort of smooth glide path into equilibrium, where, you know, deficits kind of unwound and employment came back and trade, you know, China consumed more and, you know, the U.S. saved more and everything was happy. And they, you know, you, I have a vivid memory myself of working with one of these models in about 2006 and seeing all the imbalances in it. And every time I ran it, you know, we got a happy answer. And that's a basic limitation to the assumptions and framework in these models. And so this has set off quite a bit of debate in the field of economics, is how do we account for a phenomenon like the crisis. And the field is really divided up into three camps these days. There's what Thomas Kuhn, in his book on scientific revolutions, called the diehards, the people who will go to their grave defending their paradigm, and there's a group that believes that neoclassical economics, you know, can explain the crisis. But I'd say the majority of the field is now in a middle camp of what could be called stretchers, who realize there's a need to change economic theory to stretch and adapt it to accommodate what we've seen in the crisis and some of the other things I showed, but still want to keep the core framing of the economy as an equilibrium system. And then lastly are what you could call the Kuhnians, those who think that actually the equilibrium framing of the economy itself is a problem, and we need a fresh start, a different way of looking at the economy. So I'm now going to talk about what that different way of looking at the economy might be. What if we believe the Camp 3 economists, well, how might we describe the economy? What's the alternative to this equilibrium view? And it's something that can be called a complexity economics perspective. And again, there's increasing interest in policy circles in these ideas, to try to develop tools and approaches from them. And this is the follow-on from the same speech that Trichet gave. Interest in approaches bringing together ideas from physics, engineering, biology, etc., to understand the economy is one point. A key point about these new ideas is that they are interdisciplinary. A lot of the thinking has come from the study of other complex systems in fields like biology, computer science, engineering, and so on. Now, what do we mean by this phrase, complex adaptive system? Well, a complex adaptive system is a generic way of describing a system that is complex. It's made up of lots of parts or particles or interacting agents. So think of, you know, the internet or a traffic jam or a forest ecosystem or an economy. All of them are made up of lots of distributed parts. That those distributed parts or agents or particles act their behavior in response to the environment. A biological system will respond and adapt and evolve to its environment. A computer on the internet will change its behavior based on what inputs it's getting. Its outputs will be different. Parts of the system aren't just static and staying still. They're adapting and changing. And that we can look at what scientists call emergent behavior. That as these individual parts and particles interact with each other, that you get larger patterns that come up from those interactions. So in economic terms, that could be economic growth or inflation, business cycles, unemployment, things like that would be emerge out of the micro interactions. Now here's just a little illustration of how, you know, this might look in an economic context. So if we think of the economy as made up of lots of individual agents interacting with each other, and they're heterogeneous, and occasionally those interactions come together and form coherent structures, organizations, institutions, and so on, with a common purpose. So again, you have the distributed agents, then patterns of interaction. Some of those patterns are stable over time. We call them firms, governments, things like that.
that those institutional structures also interact with their environment and change and adapt as that happens. And the CEO just got fired. Both the structure of the interactions changes as well. Agents. And then lastly, at a high level, you get other structures, collections of institutions, you know, firms forming industry structures, and you have innovation going on in the system with firms and industry sectors coming in and out. And the relationships between the agents and institutions in the over time. So this is just to be a little visual representation of that this is a gated equilibrium ball in the bowl view. So I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes talking about this idea that the economy is quite literally an evolutionary system. Now, I should first note that there's a long history of thinking of the economy as an evolutionary system. In fact, economists invented evolution. It was our idea, not the biologists. And Darwin actually admits this in his own diaries. He notes that he got the idea for natural selection from Malthus and his writings. But anyway, after Darwin stole our idea, then economists continued to develop ideas on the economy as an evolutionary system, going right up until recent times. But there's been a problem in that a lot of the work has been very kind of metaphorical, you know, thinking, well, maybe the economy is like a biological system or an evolutionary system, and has never really gotten the same traction that the neoclassical program has got. And, you know, we're accustomed to thinking of evolution as a biological phenomena. But a more modern view actually says that what evolution is it has nothing to do with biology per se. It's actually a computational phenomenon. It's a way of computing. It's an algorithm. And it just happens that DNA is a one substrate that evolution gets played out in, that the DNA provides an information processing environment, for evolution to happen in biology. But more generically, that evolution can be thought of as an algorithm or a formula for finding fit order in an environment. And the way it works is very simple, that you have some process of variety creation, of experimentation, that throws up a bunch of designs. You know, it could be designs for a biological creature, or it could be designs for, say, that chair. The key thing is you need variety in the system. Then there's some process that selects what is a fit or unfit version of that design for whatever environment it's in. And then there's some process of amplification where fit designs get scaled up and unfit designs get scaled down. And then the process is repeated. And over time, what you see are designs that evolve that are increasingly fit for their environment. And then as that environment changes, the design of whatever it is changes as well. Now, describing it in words doesn't have the same impact as actually watching it. So I'm going to see if this works. I'm going to show you a little video. It's a little bit dated, but it still gets the message across, that actually shows some computer-simulated evolution in action. This will run for just a minute or two, but it gets the idea across.
Evolution may have created billions of different living things, but it hasn't stopped there. Thanks to our invention of the computer, evolution is now producing a whole new generation of creatures.
Evolution by itself has led to the creation of incredible complexity. Ourselves, all the organisms in the world. This process happened on its own, at least in my opinion. There is nobody that assembled all of these wonderful things. On computers, we can simulate the same process, and we can get these very complicated, very interesting things without having to understand them and assemble them.
Carl Sims was one of the first researchers in what is now a burgeoning field, artificial life. He started by giving his computer the instructions for a set of basic parts.
The bodies of these creatures are fairly simple. They're just made of some number of blocks. The blocks are connected by joints, which can bend or twist. The creatures also have a nervous system. They have sensors, which can sense the angle of the joints or sense contact. And the nervous system processes the signals from the sensors and tells the muscles when to move, which generates some kind of behavior. I've given it the capabilities to include all of these elements, but the computer actually decides how they're assembled and how they're used in specific creatures.
Numbers chosen randomly by the computer, a synthetic genetic code, described how the first simple creature would look and how its nervous system would be wired. Then it was put into a simulated lake and told to swim. It twitched, but it didn't get anywhere. So now the computer went to work. Using the original numbers as its base, the computer made a few random changes, the equivalent of mutations. It did this again and again, creating a new generation of 300 different offspring. Then all the offspring got a swimming test, with the best swimmers selected as the basis for the next generation.
When the computer makes mutations in the genes of these creatures, it has no idea what these mutations are going to do. Sometimes the mutations might knock out a piece of the nervous system and perhaps cause the muscles not to move anymore. But other mutations might actually improve the motion.
So from the original creature, increasingly better swimmers evolved over generations, all without any human intervention. In the end, this was the best swimmer of all. But when Carl Sims put it on simulated land, it was like a fish out of water. So over subsequent generations, the mutation and selection process had a new goal, to walk. After 15 generations, this was the champion. Other computer runs have produced even better walkers.
Sometimes these evolving creatures would think of solutions to their goal, which were completely different than I expected. In this one example, the creatures got taller and taller and taller, and would simply fall over. Instead of figuring out some clever way of walking, they would fall to generate horizontal velocity. What I was telling them to do was to just move, and falling was a perfectly good solution as far as they're concerned. So this creature specialized in falling for as long as it possibly could, including doing a complete somersault.
I think that nicely illustrates how, even though the algorithm of evolution, this process of just creating differentiation, selection, and then amplification, despite its simplicity, is incredibly powerful. That it can create, you know, structure and design and coherence, and even can create novelty. You know, the things that surprise us, like that, you know, falling design. And also that it's a great algorithm for responding to changes in the environment. When Sims took it, the creatures from water and then put them on simulated land, the process started up again. Now, you might ask, okay, well, what does any of that have to do with the economy? We may have this process of random mutation and experimentation in biology, or we can do it on computers, but in the economy, we have humans designing lots of things. Daniel Dennett, a philosopher, likes to call evolution design without a designer. But in the economy, we have lots of designers, all of us. But when you actually look at the history of technology development in the economy, what you see is, in fact, an evolutionary process. And if I just ask you a question, who designed the modern bicycle? Well, I'd say, well, some bicycle designers. You know, somebody sat down and, you know, made up blueprints and designed it. Well, when you look at the history of the bicycle, what you actually see is something a little bit more interesting. that bicycles were first developed by Victorian tinkerers back in the early 1800s or mid 1800s, experimenting with different ways of creating wheeled transportation using materials available at the time, metal and wood and so on. And the problem is designing wheeled transportation is a very hard problem. You can't just design the optimal bicycle from first principles. If you sit down and say, what's the best possible bicycle? There is no answer to that question because you have too many variables, the materials you can use and, how it could be ridden and so on. And so people did the best they could, and they designed all kinds of varieties of bicycles, and you've probably seen them in museums, some with big wheels and three wheels, and this one which has two wheels but no pedals. You kind of shuffle along on it. And so there was this process of deduction. They weren't building bicycles with square wheels. They were trying to use their deductive intentional power to create something good. But there was a lot of tinkering going on, of experimentation. Because if any of you are trained as engineers, you can do stuff in the lab or on paper all you want, but until you try it in the real world, you never know if it's going to work. And then some of these work better than others. These ones, if you fell down off of, they hurt a lot. These ones didn't go very fast and so on. And so, over time, some of the designs were scaled up or amplified. More were made of them. And then a further process of deduction and tinkering and variation went on up until we get the modern-day bicycles, and it continues on to this day. So this process of deductive tinkering is literally an evolutionary process. We use our creativity, our intentionality, our rationality to create variety in the system. There's some criteria for what is a good and bad bicycle, and then we make more of the stuff that works and less of the stuff that doesn't. And so all through technology history, you see these evolutionary patterns of experimentation. And again, it's not random trial and error; it's intentional trial and error. But there's still trial and error going on. I argue in the book that this kind of deductive tinkering. Differentiation, selection, and amplification is going on in three key realms in the economy. One is what Dick Nelson at Columbia calls physical technologies. These are what we conventionally think of as technologies, so bicycles, microchips, ox-drawn plows, what have you. And then what he calls social technologies, which are designs for human institutions. So the invention of money, say, or the rule of law, or venture capital, or just-in-time inventory management, or the idea of having a sales force. These were all inventions, the invention of the joint stock company, which played a huge role in the Industrial Revolution, or organizing work in a factory. These are examples of social technologies. And just as one can't design the optimal factory, there's a process of deductive tinkering in these social technologies as well. Henry Ford, when he developed the first assembly line, he tried about 10 different ways before he kind of got the idea of the cars should move and the people should stand still. So again, there was this process of deductive tinkering going on. I should have mentioned in the middle that firms, businesses in the economy also have design to them. So you can think of a design for IBM or a design for Amazon or a design for BP. Similarly, the executives in those companies go through a process of intentional, deductive, trying to improve their businesses, but in the process creating variation, selecting plans that work, and putting people, capital, resources to amplify the stuff that's working and de-amplify the stuff that's not. Now, this process of business plan or firm evolution in the economy really works at multiple levels, that at an individual level, an executive in a business might be thinking, well, I could do option A or option B or option C to improve my company. That's a process of variation. I think option C is the best. That's selection, and it may be on criteria of what customers want, what shareholders want, what the regulators want, whatever the fitness environment is. And then I'm going to put people and resources or scale that up. And then that also happens at the level of organizations. People sit in an executive committee around a conference table and have a similar discussion. We could do option A, option B, option C, select one, go with it. And that also happens at the level of markets. The market
is, you know, selecting, is Amazon a better way of selling books than Waterstones? Those are two competing designs for how one might sell books. And there's a process of selection and then amplification of talent, capital, and so on, moving to the designs that are selected. Now, if one bought this idea that the economy is actually moving forward and working through this kind of deductive tinkering evolutionary process, what are some predictions that you might make? Well, evolutionary systems actually do have that kind of explosive growth and explosive collapse that we saw at the beginning. In biological systems, you know, the most famous is the Cambrian explosion, where life on Earth kind of trundled along at a low level, and then in a very short period of time, there was an explosion of innovation, variety creation, and growth of the biomass of the Earth. One could view the Industrial Revolution as a kind of economic Cambrian explosion. Evolution is in essence an algorithm for creating complexity and novelty. It's spitting out novelty and new ways of doing things all the time, and bootstrapping from the simple up to the complex. Just as you saw in that video, they started with very simple blocks, and then there was a bootstrapping process up to more and more complex designs. And again, this happens in a very bottom-up, spontaneous fashion. There's no sort of, you know, necessarily top-down direction. And a last prediction you'd make is that the order creation doesn't come for free. This is basic physics. That is, we create order, we use physical energy from the environment and put out waste and heat and greenhouse gases and other things. So there's a price to be paid. Now, going from that very sort of high-level, abstract view down to, okay, you know, what might this different view of the economy mean in a policy setting? And here I'm going to get onto even more speculative territory. If you thought that part was kind of speculative, wait till you see this part. And I'm going to talk about just a few examples that'll sort of warm us up for the breakout sessions. I'm first going to start at the level of technical tools. At a very technical level, there's just new ways of doing modeling and analysis coming out of this that I think are pretty interesting, and I'll show a couple of examples. And as you know, people involved in policymaking know, you know, the models and analysis matters. That often, you know, frames the discussion that ministers have and policy decisions are made from. Second, there are also just conceptual frameworks, new ways of thinking about problems, of understanding them, and so on. And then third, I'll ask, are there some higher-level methodological things that we can take away from this, including the system stewardship work that the Institute for Government's been doing? And then lastly, just a little bit more philosophically, I believe that this kind of thinking actually changes some of the political conversation as well about how we think about things like the role of the state. So first, just a couple more technical examples, and here I'm going to see if the internet's working, because I want to show you a live example. So this is a technology that's called an agent-based model. So this is a way that's been developed of modeling these kind of complex systems, and it's based on a simple philosophy. If you're trying to model a bunch of individual things interacting in complex ways that create some emergent behavior, well, the best way to do that is to model the individual things and see what happens. And this kind of modeling has been used for all sorts of things, from understanding epidemics and the spread of disease to traffic management. To the military has started to use this technology a lot to model battlefield scenarios and things like this. And I'm going to show you one that was developed to a health example to model the emergency room of a hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And what you see here is the actual layout. This is the real physical layout of the hospital. And you can see the agents, the individuals, moving around. There's a little, and even some of the equipment, that's a gurney going. And you've got patients coming in, either via ambulance or walk-in. Then being seen to by here all the nurses are having their tea in there, and the doctors are hanging out doing whatever doctors do in there. But as patients come in, there goes a nurse, goes out to see what's going on. There's a patient in the waiting room. She brings the patient back, takes to a treatment room. That patient then waits for hours to see the physician, and so on. So you can kind of get the idea.
Now, the neat thing about these types of models is you can actually calibrate them with real data. So in this case, they actually, you know, had good data on what kind of cases were walking through the door from ambulances and so on, and even at different times of the day. The reason why it's so slow now is this is 4 a.m. I'll speed it up a little bit. And you see it gets a lot busier as we go through the day. But you can calibrate it with real data. And then things like physical space matters, how long it takes people to walk places, the physical layout of the rooms, and staffing levels and so on. And you can also then, you know, measure statistics, how much is equipment and people being utilized, do you have log jams in places, and so on. And then you can run all sorts of what-if scenarios. So, you know, let's say we wanted to move the express care unit, you know, down here, or change a staffing level of nurses, or change the staffing levels of the registrar. You know, you can play with this in all sorts of ways. But the key thing is it gives you a granularity and realism that you just can't get from a more aggregated model. You know, if you used a sort of a high level model that just looked at utilization rates or something like that, you wouldn't be able to do that. So this is one, this sort of more kind of technical example of a complexity approach. And I'm going to now talk about another use of modeling, which is in these big macro models that central banks and finance ministries use. And just to demonstrate how those work today, sorry, I've got another short video. This is how the models inside that central banks use work today. Basically, you assume that there's an exogenous shock coming from outside the system, like this finger poking the jelly, and then the economy, represented by the jello, wiggles and moves and responds to that exogenous shock and goes through, you know, a set of oscillations or you know, volatility. But then it eventually settles back down into an equilibrium state. But as I described before, that assumes that all the interesting stuff is happening in the finger, the exogenous shock, rather than coming endogenously from the dynamics of the system. Now, you know, the subprime crisis wasn't just a giant finger from the sky kind of poking the system. You know, the system had a set of flaws and vulnerabilities in it to begin with. So we would like a more endogenous way of looking at this. So I'm currently involved in a major effort that's just getting started to build an agent-based model of the financial system. So think of that ER or A&E model, but for the financial system with banks, with households, you know, borrowing money, getting mortgages and things like that, with individual firms producing their stuff, also getting commercial loans and so on, and then sitting in the middle in the gray lady at bank, having to respond with policy in this system. And this is still in early stages, but we think it's quite promising, and we're actually having good collaboration from the Bank of England and from the ECB and the New York Fed as well on trying to build this model. And just as with that A&E model, you want to be able to experiment, well, if we reconfigured the system this way or that way, what would be the scenarios and implications? Or in the case of something like the Greek crisis, you could model, you know, different scenarios for contagion and so on. Now, a couple of more just quick conceptual examples. There's been some interesting work looking at growth policy and actually looking at economic growth as an evolutionary system, as we discussed before. This is some work by Hausman and Hidalgo at Harvard, where they've actually mapped the network of products and capabilities in a whole set of economies and built these lovely network maps that show the interconnections and relations between different sectors in the economy. And this is a typical industrial economy, and so you see, you know, the agricultural sectors over here automotives and electronics and so on. And each of these bubbles represents a set of products and capabilities that are required and assets required to support those products. And as they have analyzed these network structures and watched how they evolve over time, because they've done it at different slices in time, what they see is that there's this branching process in the product space. So, you know, automotive technologies yield, you know, over time aerospace technologies, for example, or semiconductor industries then evolve into consumer electronics businesses, as in the case of Taiwan or Korea, for example. And that as this, you know, and that what firms are trying to do is find new profitable spaces in this kind of, you know, product space. But as Hausman likes to say, the monkeys can't jump far from the trees. That if you're looking for, you know, trees with more fruit in the forest, you know, you're kind of hopping from tree to tree. You can't just miraculously, you know, go from electronics over to, you know, whatever's over here, garments or vice versa. That there's a sort of a traversing path that one has to take, and that these traversing paths then in turn depend on clusters of capabilities and skills. And so this then leads to some interesting policy questions. You know, if you understood these structures and the skills and potential paths, you know, could you design more targeted and effective growth policies? And this approach is also being looked at in the context of economic development, because one thing we see is that these structures of the product and capability space look very different in industrialized countries versus, say, sub-Saharan Africa. And in essence, you know, what many development failures are involving is where we're trying to sort of plunk down a set of capabilities in a part of the space that isn't kind of currently occupied or underpopulated. And as Hausman said, it's in essence like, you know, trying to turn a fish into a tree frog. You know, we haven't sort of gone through the evolutionary path. Because we're running a bit late on time, I'm going to save this for if there's a small development group that breaks out, we can talk about some other hypotheses for development. Another example where you might have a conceptual shift is climate change. And in a complex systems view, climate change isn't viewed just as an externality in the system, but actually the climate is a part of the complex system that the economy exists in. This is basic physics, in fact, that, you know, coming into the agents interacting, buying and selling and making things in the economy are real energy inputs from fossil fuels and from calories from agriculture, and that's creating the ordered outputs in the system, the goods and services, and also the disordered outputs of waste products, heat and gas. So in these types of models, looking at climate effects isn't just sort of an afterthought or an add-in. It's actually something that's quite embedded in the whole way that one thinks about these systems. And just to be a little bit more specific, if we look at the traditional economic assumptions around climate change and much environmental planning, see that, you know, there's often, again, assumptions that people are behaving perfectly rationally, that risk is distributed in nice bell curves. In most of these models, it doesn't get called out much, but the time is reversible. You can run things forward and backwards equally well, that they're linear, you know, that the production function in these models is, in essence, infinite, that there's no physical limitations of resources like energy or materials. And we've already talked about a very, you know, limited view of innovation. A complexity view allows you to incorporate, again, more realistic behavior, how do real consumers behave and real companies behave, to deal with the irreversibility. So, for example, in the real climate system, if the methane comes out of Siberia, you can't stuff it back in. You know, that's an irreversible process, and things like that need to be taken into account. You've probably all heard about, you know, the notion that there's tipping points in the climate system, and so on. So, you know, this offers a way of thinking about climate problems that is more tuned to the reality of the interlinked economic and climate system. In terms of overall methodologies, I would just like to call out the work that the Institute for Government has done on this notion of system stewardship. That, and I think copies of the paper are outside. But the basic notion that the authors put forward is that the role of policymaking isn't to be the optimal designer. You know, Just as we can't design the optimal bicycle from first principles, designing often the optimal policies from first principles is an even harder, more impossible problem. That rather, the role of the policymaker is to set overall goals and rules and guidelines, what in an evolutionary context might be called the fitness part of the fitness function. So, you know, part of the what we think of as the fitness environment for the economy in our society would be that companies don't steal, they don't kill their consumers, they treat labor responsibly. You know, other things could be part of that fitness response. And then the system adapts and evolves in response to those fitness constraints, and then there's feedback from the system, which then allows adjustments and adaptations in the policy. So rather than command-control, this sort of system stewardship. And the authors note that, you know, that there's a spectrum of this, that there may be some situations where command and control is necessary, where, you know, something has to be done exactly in a certain way the first time. So say there's a, you know, safety issue or something like that, where it's a relatively simple problem and where also capacity in the system for the actors to adapt may be limited. You may still go in a very direct kind of more command and control way. But when there is scope for adaptation, when the, you know, the optimal answer can't be known in advance, when, you know, some experimentation could be tolerated, then this type of approach may be better. And, you know, this raises an interesting question. Evolutionary systems are systems of experimentation. You know, the key thing that makes them work is this process of variety creation and then getting feedback from the environment and adjusting and so on. So an interesting question is, can we actually do real experimentation in policy making? Now, it's much harder, you know, than, say, in a laboratory, but it can be done. And you know, there are examples of experiments in things like education policy, health policy. I was with some folks doing development work a couple of weeks ago, and I was very impressed. It, you know, real rigorous, you know, control field trials, you know, on development policies in Africa, for example. Now, you know, from a technical policy standpoint, experimentation often is both desirable and possible. The harder problem is the politics of it, because, you know, for a politician to say, well, we don't exactly know the optimal way to solve this problem, so we're going to try five things. You know, we'll do this in the Northeast and that in the Southeast and this in Wales and that in Scotland and let the thing run. And then, you know, the people in the Northeast, it doesn't work out so well. You know, then everyone wants to know whose fault it is. And so somehow we need to square the circle between the value of doing experimentation in policy with the political difficulties that it creates. And then lastly, and I'll wrap up, just, you know, that I believe that this view of the economy as a complex system also can influence our politics. You know, if we think about what we've seen over the past few decades, that, you know, we've seen the end of one era, that the notion that state planning can, you know, lead to good outcomes in the economy basically collapsed with the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And then at the other extreme, you know, we've seen that, you know, a real hands-off, laissez-faire approach to markets has also not worked out so well in the recent financial crash. And, you know, that our old political frameworks of left versus right have been sort of disoriented and kind of scrambled a bit by this. And, you know, so there's a lot of questions. Well, is the answer just a sort of a kind of a compromise in the middle somewhere, a bit of state, a bit of market, and we all kind of, you know, get along and make it work? Or is there a different way of framing it? And, you know, I would just put up that complexity economics offers the potential to think about this in a different way, that, you know, if we take the traditional position of the left that markets may be necessary but don't produce just outcomes, but states are an essential mechanism for ensuring social justice and protecting people from market failures, to the right's view that markets are the most efficient mechanism for allocating resources, and so almost by definition, anything that states do distorts or takes away from that efficiency, and so you have the imperative that state interference should be minimized. A complexity view would say that actually neither of these is quite right. that markets as evolutionary systems are not perfectly efficient in allocation. Evolutionary systems are hugely inefficient, in fact, and create a lot of waste. But what markets as evolutionary systems are good at is that innovation process and that evolutionary process of wealth creation. They're highly effective. But for that evolutionary process to work, the state has to create the institutional conditions for that evolution, and also shapes the fitness function, as I described before, that's occurring in. So it starts to ask then different questions about the role of the state, such as, well, how can we make economic evolution work better? How can we orient the fitness function toward the needs of society, and so on? So just to wrap up, the argument is that human social systems, including the economy, are complex adaptive systems, and they grow through evolutionary processes, that this view of the economy can explain some things that have been previously hard to explain by traditional economic theory, and that this may lead to better policies. And just to Albert Einstein, I always like this Einstein quote, that we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them. And I'll give Bob the Builder the last word. Shameless advertising. Thank you.
So that was an amazing tour de force by Eric. Well, we're slightly off timing, she said, thinking how to adapt now. So why don't we just start off with anyone here who's got some sort of general questions, comments, et cetera, and see whether that, before we then see whether we've got time to run some discussions in breakout sessions. Any questions, or is it also blindingly obvious? Been thinking this all along? Yes. Can you say who you are? We've got a microphone roving around. So, yeah.
Jeremy Mayhew. I thought it was very interesting. The only thing that I question is how revolutionary it is. I mean, on the one hand, who has ever believed the sort of perfect market assumptions in the economic textbooks? The basic argument, as I've always been understood it, is their approximations, which are valid or not according to their predictive power. That's a summary. But more particularly, it struck me that a lot of what you said would have been, and I know you mentioned him in passing, would have been very familiar in Hayek's work, with his arguments about markets as discovery mechanisms, the emphasis on trial and error, the deep skepticism about planning and top-down. And I just wonder what your attitude to his thinking is, even if you wouldn't necessarily agree with what you said about the role of the state at the end.
Okay, let's take a couple. We've got, there, and then we've got some complexity experts coming back at you. So.
Thank you. I half agree, in the sense that
you are.
One of the first things I did when I was a policy advisor was look at an impact assessment, which was perfectly based on the economic rational model, and I was asked to give a view on it, and I said, well, it's all made up. It doesn't, you know. I still had to get a minister to sign it off. A lot of what you said, it strikes me, based in the tradition of systems practice and systems thinking, in a sense, it would be great if economics, as the dismal science, caught up with most other sciences and started to be systemic in how it thought about things. So if that's part of this journey, that's got to be fantastic. Very particular question, though. Piloting, isn't there an implication in some of what you've said that the state at the center can't pilot? It can only create conditions that allow other people to pilot and then to learn from those things and perhaps tweak the conditions that it's got, because, as you said, well, for lots of reasons, but that evolutionary dynamic isn't at the center, it's out in the field.
Okay, let's just take a third one here.
Thank you, Orit Gal. It seems that complexity economics really came a long way in terms of taking from natural sciences and really showing and moving from static to dynamic look at economics. But I think that in terms of really being effective and the real revolutionary shift will really only come when you also reframe what the economy actually is and what are the actually boundaries of that jello. Because you can't really think about systemic collapse without thinking about the politics of home ownership or about policy preference for consumption rise versus pay rise, preemptive discourse on national security and environment, et cetera, et cetera. And I just noticed that there is no politics and politicians in the new models. You have markets, organization, individuals, and even in the project crisis, there are no politicians.
Yep.
It's quite an interesting note of your model, actually, I thought. No voters, no politicians. Why don't we take those ones? So no role for the state, no politicians, and it's actually what we were taught at Oxford 500 years ago or whatever, stuff like that.
Exactly.
So.
Well, first on the question of, well, you know, did economists never believe this perfect rationality stuff? You know, you're right. They've always said, well, it's just an approximation. But, you know, there's and all science is an approximation. You know, even particle physics is an approximation of some reality. But one scientist described a good analogy. It's like having a map of the world. You know, your road map is an approximation of the real road system you're seeing. You know, it doesn't have all the detail. There's assumptions and so on. But it has to be fidelity with that real world. You know, if your map says the road's going this way and the real road's going this way, then it's not a very useful map. And that's been the problem with traditional economics. It's a bad approximation. And there's, you know, a huge body of empirical evidence showing that we don't behave rationally or that, you know, these network structures do matter and so on. So the argument is that, you know, this is just a better map. And you're right, it's not all completely new by any stretch. There's a long, I didn't have time to go into it, but there's a very long intellectual tradition kind of underneath this, including, and I would put Hayek very much in that tradition, Schumpeter and Veblen and Marshall and quite a number of others. But the things really kind of took off starting in the 80s because we got computers. Complex systems are hard to understand with just pencil and paper, and it helps a lot to have computers. And things biologists and physicists and others were doing provided new tools. On the question of, well, first I agree with your comment on systems thinking, and can the state pilot? Well, you know, as in a democracy, we charge the state with taking care of certain problems. And we expect the state to take care of certain problems. And so the state has to go through its own kind of deductive tinkering process in trying to come up with solutions and improve them and so on. So I would say absolutely the state not only can but should be piloting and trying an experimental approach as much as it can, you know, again, subject to the constraint of politics, which takes me to the last question, and you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the economy is a complex system sitting in a whole nest of other complex systems, some of them human social systems like our political systems or, you know, national security issues. You know, we've got, you know, within that things like culture and values and all sorts of things going on. And then that whole human social system is then embedded in the larger physical system of the environment. So another question in science is, in any model, where do you draw the boundaries? Because, you know, you can't, you know, model the whole thing, or if you try to, your model becomes as complicated as what you're trying to model, and you don't understand it any better. So we always have to draw boundaries. So the question is, for the problem that you're looking at, what are the relative systems that you need to capture? So, you know, for some, you know, politics and political economy absolutely could be, you know, very core, or environment or other issues. But those are decisions that you have to make.
Okay, so another quick round of, I have to see. We'll go to the back, come here, and then I'm going to allow Mike to have a word. Yeah. Dave, who you are?
Hi, I'm Anne Griffiths. I work in Ealing Council. Just a very simple question, really. How do you envisage this being, what the outcomes would be when it's practically applied to public policy, and what you think the best possible outcomes of that might be?
Yeah.
Tim Harford from the Financial Times. And I would recommend Eric's book, The Origin of Wealth, to everybody. It's wonderful. That said, Eric, I'm going to call you on something. So you showed us a picture of Spock. You said behavioral economics, very important, and the complexity view incorporates that. You quoted Trichet as saying he would love solutions from engineering. That seems perfectly sensible. Wouldn't it be great to have psychologically more complex models? Wouldn't it be great to, when we think about how financial systems melt down, wouldn't it be great to think about sort of the engineering perspective of, you know, safety systems, how they all work? But these are not really evolutionary biology models, and you showed us Cesar Hidalgo's work. That's network physics. He maps networks. It's not an evolutionary model. And the main thrust of what you were telling us was agent-based modeling is a wonderful way to look at this, but agent-based models have very simple assumptions about individual behavior and individual motivations. So that's actually moving further away from realism, whereas behavioral economics is moving towards realism. Now, all of these approaches seem to me very fertile. The question is, are we really looking at a new paradigm, or are we looking at a patchwork of very different approaches that don't necessarily sit well together?
Okay, and finally.
Michael Halsworth. Thank you for a fantastic presentation, Eric. I just wanted to ask you about the evolutionary fitness of some of these ideas for the government sphere, because about 9-10 years ago, there's a really good pamphlet by a guy called Jake Chapman for Demos System Failure, I think it was called, which basically set out a lot of this thinking and applied it to government. However, it happened to coincide with a very, if you say, directive period of top-down sort of target-based culture in the way that the state was conceived of. And Jake went around Whitehall for a number of years. It had a fair amount of impact, but it kind of died away again. Do you feel that there is the opportunity this time for it to take hold in a much more fundamental way, with perhaps the opportunity for after the collapse of the financial markets and so on, and the current government's commitment to decentralization? Could it break through and have more success this time, or will there be a retrenchment once more?
I think that goes a bit actually to Anne's question as well of actually, so what's the case for this in terms of offering sort of practical better outcomes? So
I'll take those two together, but I'll first come to Tim's excellent question, and I'll also hawk his book.
I was going to say his
Adapt, which
is good,
absolutely brilliant, and would have been a much more fun read on the beach this summer than my.
I've read that as well, but that's a train ride book. Your book takes a whole holiday with Tim's. Tim's is a train ride. Anyway,
so
it's a very good train ride, but.
So, well, first, there were a couple points in your question. You know, the point about behavioral realism in these models is a very difficult one, because, on the one hand, human behavior is so complex and rich, we will never capture it in any model fully. There will always be aspects of it that are left out or just not even understood. The key point is that even though we're mysterious creatures with free will, et cetera, there's a lot of regularities in human behavior. I will bet that if we had a break and all went and got tea and came back, you'd come and sit in your same seat. I could make that prediction, and it would probably be mostly successful. People behave in regular ways. So the key thing is to understand what regularities of behavior are important for the problem that you're looking at and trying to capture those. And, there's no kind of one answer to that. In the agent-based modeling literature, there are models that actually have zero intelligence agents that assume the opposite of traditional economics, assume everybody is perfectly stupid, and then see what happens. And that often sort of highlights what the structural, impacts are that you take behavior out, and then put in sort of more rich and realistic behavior and see how that changes it. So, the way I think of behavioral economics is, this is a great, rich set of empirical results that can be drawn on in doing this kind of economics. On your point about Hidalgo's work is, you're right, that's a network analysis. I described it as evolutionary because they've looked at this over time, and it leads to some thinking about, well, if these network structures are important in understanding economic growth, well, how those networks change over time could be a subject of interest to growth policy. And that's actually some new work that's underway to look at that. Your last point about, is this a paradigm or a patchwork, I think is a fair question. There is no overarching theory of complex systems. In fact, that might even be a contradiction in terms. But we, through a whole set of tools and approaches, we can gain insight into complex systems. And it's what philosophers of science call a research program would probably be a better description than a paradigm. But I'm optimistic that by applying these multifaceted approaches, we can learn a lot more about how these systems work. Now, on the question of what would you get benefit? I'd say there's still too few actually hard case examples of here's how we did it the old way, here's how we do it the new way. New way was different and better. Where there are examples are in outside of economics and things like health policy, so endemic prevention. A lot of the work that was done on bird flu and other things used these types of complex systems approaches and did come up with very different policy interventions and different analyses of the system. The military also has examples as well. Economics, we're really only just getting started. The question of, why hasn't this taken root? These ideas have been kicking around for some time. Well, some of it is just human. People have been trained in a certain way. They went to university, studied economics this way. That's how you do things. It has credibility, and so on. It's hard to get people to change their thinking. And, the neoclassical economics paradigm took several decades to get rooted. If you look at when Samuelson and Arrow's work was done in the 40s and 50s and so on, it really only started getting rooted in public policy in kind of the 70s, 80s, 90s. So, by that standard, we still got about 20 years, to work on this. I'm hoping it'll happen faster, and the crisis has been a big accelerator in making people more open and interested in this kind of thinking. Now, someone like, a central bank is not going to just chuck their current model out the window and go with something like this, and they shouldn't. But rather, a careful process of continuing to use the old models, build new ones, experiment, compare, contrast, that seems very valuable.
I think we've got 5.5 weeks to save the euro, haven't we? So we need to put you on a sort of very fast track. Let's just take a couple more questions, then we'll see and try and combine the drinks social session with some structured networking. Okay, I've got three, so I'm going to go there, there, and then here. That's who you are as well.
Luke Robinson. I'm a physicist, and I've worked in ecology and things like this. If you have multiple systems competing against each other, don't you you have a lot of redundancy, so there's a cost. So you have to, probably from a policy perspective, sell that this cost is going to create us advantages. And I think that's probably going to be a very hard thing to sell to the public sort of thing. That was just a comment.
Okay. And then in front of you, yes, here, I think.
Tom Aldred, Cabinet Office. One recent public policy issue that I don't think traditional economics has explained very well is the London riots. I just wondered whether your model explains that any better.
Okay, and...
Hi, Sam Timms, Institute for Government. Often in the policy literature, when people are applying complexity theory, the standard thing to say is that this means we should be doing more kind of slow adaptation, more piloting and things like that. Now, I can totally see how more slow adaptation and feeling your way, and as you've helpfully described tonight, deductive tinkering is useful. But it seems to me that complexity, seeing the world as complex, might make piloting even less useful than it is in a normal world. Since if the world's characterized by all these kind of riotous non-linearities, then any small differences in a policy program in the pilot stage might make the results as it's rolled out totally different.
Okay. Very good set of questions there.
Excellent. First on the question of efficiency versus redundancy, you're absolutely right. Evolutionary systems are hugely inefficient and have lots of redundancy and waste in them. And there's a well-known trade-off in complex evolutionary systems between system robustness and, that degree of redundancy in the system. And what often can happen in complex systems is that if a system is stable for a period of time, it will actually drive to some notion of efficiency. The inefficient gets weeded out. But then that makes it more brittle when things change. And so the worst kind of environment for evolutionary systems is something that's sort of stable, 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 and then bang, something happens. You have to adjust, and then stable, stable, stable. It's actually easier to either be, you know, stable or volatile. And you know, the economy does tend to be a bit like that. You know, where we go through a period like the 90s where things are relatively stable, and then we have these periods of turbulence. So you know, the answer is that to make the system more robust, there is going to have to be inefficiency in it, and you know, resilience. Now, engineers think this way. You know, when you build a bridge, you don't build the most efficient bridge. You put in error margin in it, and you know, we need that a bit more of that kind of thinking. London riots, I think, would be a great example of an opportunity to apply some of this thinking. I have seen some modeling work in political science on political change. You know, there was some modeling of the Berlin Wall dynamics and, you know, sort of the social network effects and so on. And I think there's some folks doing work on the Arab Spring type stuff, and that could also be applied in a less positive sense to the riots. On the question, great question about, you know, pilots, you know, if you're taking lots of time to put pilots into an environment that itself is changing, you know, faster than you're learning from the pilots, you've got a problem. So, you know, then if you need to kind of then start rethinking about what do we mean by pilot. Is what we usually think of as pilot is a top-down program designed by somebody sitting somewhere, you know, that we're doing at a small scale, and then we measure it and then make it bigger. So piloting is still kind of a way of doing top-down policy. So in a fast-moving environment, I would think about, are there sort of more distributed bottom-up solutions that may not be piloting? You may be actually doing whatever it is, but creating mechanisms to allow, you know, learning from one part of the system to transmit more sort of horizontally rather than up and down to another part of the system. And Eve's shaking her head. She's probably actually done this.
I think Greg, very keen to... Greg, who helped us set up these seminars.
Thank you. Greg Fisher. I'm heading up a think tank. I'm going to plug myself, if you don't mind, Jill. I'm heading up a think tank with Paul Ormerod to take this thinking actually into the policy terrain. So come and talk to me later if you want. Sorry, Jill. The question I got, Eric,
the book
is actually
as well, Greg.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Paul has actually just written a new book. I'm going to turn this into a question about the big society, really. It links in what you just said about sort of question of decision-making power and so on and so forth at different levels of society. Do you think complexity has anything to kind of add to big society debate at all, particularly related to power and responsibility amongst the population in different layers, levels?
Okay, so any last burning question? Yes, one there.
Carl Allen, I'm retired, so things are fairly simple for me. I had wondered, will we move from complexity economics to something simpler, something perhaps elegant, or are we going to be stuck? Or will we have to move to become complex?
Great. Well, first on Greg's question, like a good civil servant, I'm going to say resolutely politically neutral. I think the basic ideas behind big society and tapping into a more bottom-up approach and values and norms and bringing different actors into solving social problems could fit into a complexity framework, and I know there's been some interest in looking at that. So I would sort of tee that up as a to be explored topic, and same also with the arguments over devolution would be another. You know, it'd be interesting to look at as part of that through a complexity lens. You've given us a great philosophical question to end with: complexity versus simplicity. You know, an interesting thing about complex systems can sometimes be very simple. You know, when you analyze them, what you may find is that what looks like quite complex, messy behavior is actually coming from just one simple little thing, down in the system. An example somebody once gave me was, if you ask why has the U.S. had such bad urban sprawl, in strip malls and things like that? That you'd think that's a very complex phenomenon out of all sorts of factors, but this person made actually a pretty persuasive argument that a simple change in planning rules on square footage of parking per square footage of retail space actually lay at the heart of a whole chain of economic and social decision making, which then kind of rippled out and created these changes. So sometimes a change in one sensitive part of the system, one little rule here or there, can have actually quite big disproportionate effects. Or another example would be a regulatory change of what's called it may be called something different in Britain, but in the U.S. it was called the prudent man policy. Sorry, this was the 70s, so it was a bit more sexist. Created the whole private equity and venture capital industry. It was just a change in how investors were supposed to behave. So sometimes at the heart of messy complexity is simplicity. But your question of, well, do we have to become more complex in our thinking? I think that's also true too. And this goes back to the earlier comment about systems thinking. I think that we have to also train our brains to actually look at things in a more system way, to understand dynamics. And so when we are simplifying, we're using the right kind of mental tools to do so.
Okay, I think that's a brilliant point to end this bit. So what we're going to do, she said, is apart from plugging future policymaking events at IFG, so keep looking at our website, some flyers on about that, is what we thought we'd do is give you a chance to think through applying these concepts in some areas. So we've actually tagged, I think, seven people who are up for standing by a bit of magic paper or whiteboard to help you talk about these things. So I'm going to name who they are and where they're going to be. What I suggest we do is, usually in the IFG, you get a free drink. But what I suggest is, now you grab a drink, and then you gravitate towards one of these. If, as I said earlier, you want to talk about something different, you can nominate that you want to talk about that differently from other people, or you can just hang around and have a drink with people. But I think it would be really interesting. I'm going to ask Eric to rove and join your discussions. He's not going to mock you out of 10 or anything as to whether you get it or not. We've also got some other sort of experts in complexity. We've got Greg, we've got Eve Middleton, Kelly from LSE. So we've got other people who are up with that. Tim, I think, is sort of a complexity expert and very happy to do that. Anyway, so we'll get some people to rove around and join your discussions. So the topics we selected, which may, of course, be wrong, but they bear an uncanny relationship to those listed by Eric, are growth with Philip Rutnam. Philip is a DG at Business Innovation Skills, and we've put Philip appropriately in the boardroom. Sounds a bit like The Apprentice, but anyway, in this room we have climate change. We have Ravi Gurumurthy, who will do this, but Ravi is very happy if none of you want to come, because he basically wants to go to the growth discussion. But if you'd like to talk about climate change, Ravi, who is Director of Strategy at the Department of Energy and Climate Change, will come here. In that room we have a double act of David Knott and Katrina Lang, who will talk about international development and poverty reduction. If you want to talk about that, they'll be in the innovation room over that side. Tom Aldred, who was asked the question about the riots, has a chance to talk about. We've asked Tom if he'd like to lead a bit of a discussion about cities and regeneration. Out on the landing and nearest to the drinks, we have Orrit Gall, who asked a question earlier, is going to talk about national security. And there's some very difficult questions Eric's given about that, but you can talk about other things as well. And then Adrian Brown, who worked on any number of public service reform white papers, will talk to you about, does any of this have any application to public services? And he's going to be on the other side of the landing. Does anyone think, actually, I really want to talk about... I keep on trying to get the IFG to discuss the Eurozone, but for us, Europe doesn't exist, which means we can all sleep much happier in our beds anyway. So if anyone wants to talk about anything else, offer up. We can supply you with notes and white. Anyway, so if you are up for a bit of discussion and networking over drinks and just trying that, let's see what happens. It almost looked like your agent-based modelling, as everybody goes there to get a drink and then comes back. We'll try and allocate some IFG people around. We were going to say, let's all come back and discuss, but actually, I think let's not do that. Eric will roam around and talk to you and see. So it's a chance just to discuss, does any of this actually help you think about things in a bit differently? But we will have some IFG people to try and capture some of that thinking and feedback to us. And of course, Mike Holsworth will be lurking around and telling you all how to be system stewards everywhere. But before we do that, let's just thank Eric for a terrific tour de course talk.